Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We are up to Epilogue 1, Chapter 4. The flood of nations begins to subside into its normal channels. The waves of the great movement abate, and on the calm surface eddies are formed in which float the diplomatists who imagine that they have caused the floods to abate. But the smooth sea again suddenly becomes disturbed. The diplomatists think that their disagreements are the cause of this fresh pressure of natural forces. They anticipate war between their sovereigns. The position seems to them insoluble. But the wave they feel to be rising does not come from the quarter they expect. It rises again from the same point as before, Paris. The last backwash of the movement from the west occurs, a backwash which serves to solve the apparently insuperable diplomatic difficulties and ends the military movement of that period of history. The man who had devastated France returns to France alone, without any conspiracy and without soldiers. Any guard might arrest him, but by a strange chance no one does so, and all rapturously greet the man they cursed the day before, and will curse again a month later. This man is still needed to justify the final collective act. That act is performed. The last role is played. The actor is bidden to disrobe and wash off his powder and paint. He will not be wanted any more. And some years pass, during which he plays a pitiful comedy to himself in solitude on his island, justifying his actions by intrigues and lies when the justification is no longer needed, and displaying to the whole world what it was that people had mistaken for strength as long as an unseen hand directed his actions. The manager, having brought the drama to a close and stripped the actor, shows him to us. See what you believed in? This is he. Do you now see that it was not he but I who moved you? But dazed by the force of the movement, it was long before people understood this. Still greater coherence and inevitability is seen in the life of Alexander I, the man who stood at the head of the counter-movement from east to west. What was needed for him who, overshadowing others, stood at the head of that movement from east to west? What was needed was a sense of justice and a sympathy with European affairs, but a remote sympathy not dulled by petty interests, a moral superiority over those sovereigns of the day who cooperated with him. A mild and attractive personality and a personal grievance against Napoleon. And all this was found in Alexander I. All this had been prepared by innumerable so-called chances in his life. His education, his early liberalism, the advisers who surrounded him, and by Austerlitz and Tilsit and Erfurt. During the National War he was inactive because he was not needed, but as soon as the necessity for a general European war presented itself, he appeared in his place at the given moment, and uniting the nations of Europe led them to the goal. The goal is reached. After the final war of 1815, Alexander possesses all possible power. How does he use it? Alexander I, the pacifier of Europe, the man who from his early years had striven only for his people's welfare, the originator of the liberal innovations of his fatherland, now that he seemed to possess the utmost power and therefore to have the possibility of bringing about the welfare of his peoples, at the time when Napoleon in exile was drawing up childish and mendacious plans of how he would have made mankind happy had he retained power, Alexander I, having fulfilled his mission and feeling the hand of God upon him, suddenly recognizes the insignificance of that supposed power, turns away from it, and gives it into the hands of contemptible men whom he despises, saying only, "Not unto us, not unto us, but unto thy name. I too am a man like the rest of you. Let me live like a man, and think of my soul and of gold, of God. As the sun and each atom of ether is a sphere complete in itself, and yet at the same time only a part of a whole too immense for man to comprehend, so each individual bears within himself his own aims, and yet bears them to serve a general purpose incomprehensible to man. A bee, settling on a flower, has stung a child, and the child is afraid of bees and declares that bees exist to sting people. A poet admires the bee sucking from the chalice of a flower, and says it exists to suck the fragrance of flowers. A beekeeper, seeing the bee collect pollen from flowers and carry it to the hive, says that it exists to gather honey. Another beekeeper who has studied the life of the hive more closely says that the bee gathers pollen dust to feed the young bees and rear a queen, and that it exists to perpetuate its race. A botanist notices that the bee flying with the pollen of a male flower to a pistil fertilizes the latter, and sees in this the purpose of the bee's existence. Another, observing the migration of plants, notices that the bee helps in this work, and many say that in this lies the purpose of the bee. But the ultimate purpose of the bee is not exhausted by the first, the second, or any of the processes the human mind can discern. The higher the human intellect rises in the discovery of these purposes, the more obvious it becomes that the ultimate purpose is beyond our comprehension. All that is accessible to man is the relation of the life of the bee to other manifestations of life, and so it is with the purpose of historic characters and nations. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. And I'm just going to do a quick bit of advertising here. This podcast is brought to you by Audible, the most awesome audiobook service that exists. Audible has an unrivaled library of audiobooks, and you can get a free 1 month trial, which includes a free audiobook of your choosing from their library, by going to audibletrial.com/ander. audibletrial.com/ander. Get yourself into a new audiobook. Thank you kindly for your patience there. Now, this chapter was really, I hope, it seemed like the summary to this big long point that Tolstoy's been making about historians trying to explain everything and then summing it up with this analogy of bees, saying that you can drill down into further and further detail of what the bee is doing, why it's doing it, what are the effects of it. But the further and further you go in analyzing the bee, the clearer it becomes that there is actually no reason, or that it's beyond human comprehension, the true purpose of a bee. Even though you can figure out all these clever little things about it, you don't really know just what the heck a bee is and why it exists. Something like that. And that seems like the end of his point, right? He's been talking about how wrong the historians are, and they're, all the things they say are biased or exaggerated, etc. But really, he's saying that the whole historical account is just well and truly beyond our comprehension. But then, with all that said, then, I don't know, it kind of invalidates his own opinion, because really, he's nothing much more than just another historian himself. I'm reminded a little of Pierre, who has sort of just stopped trying to understand everything and just be happy to sort of let it wash over him. And he makes his decisions based on just kind of more gut feelings, just observing what he can, and then making his decisions, making his points, rather than analyzing and analyzing. It's almost like that Occam's razor. You just observe and then whatever's the most likely seeming outcome is usually correct. And then you can analyze and analyze and analyze down to deeper and deeper levels, go into higher and higher resolution. But more often than not, you're going to come back to that original assessment. Or indeed, you'll just figure out that it's beyond understanding. Too Clever by 87/15 said, "I don't understand this chapter at all. Is Tolstoy for or against Alexander retiring when he could have brought about the welfare of all his people? He seems to be saying that Alexander might have done it, but wanted to live his own life, which is in line with his themes, but it's hardly illusory power, if you can actually do it. Maybe he's trying to say that it would have failed anyway because something historical determinism, but heck, he could have tried." Yeah, look, my theory on Alexander is he wasn't really that active or instrumental during the invasion or during his reign at all. I think he was more of a figurehead, and that all the real decision-making and strategizing was done by his military leaders and his advisors. And I think similarly, once the war was over and he could have brought about the welfare of all his people, so to speak, but didn't because he decided to retire instead, I think it was just him stepping aside from a role that it just seems like he was out of his control. You know, if that thing was going to happen, it was going to happen by those same advisors and strategists. I don't know, Tolstoy doesn't really seem to want to admit. He'll say over and over that Napoleon really wasn't instrumental or influential. But then he does give Alexander this kind of, he credits him with the ability to do these things. Seems a bit of a cop-out. I really don't understand it all that well either, Too Clever. But I think at this point we can basically chalk it up to Russia good, France bad. Historians also bad. Now, we are moving closer and closer to the end of the year. The Hemingway List the Hemingway List subreddit is growing. We're now up to 56 readers. I think a couple of days ago I was happy to announce we'd passed 30. So it's growing at a rather satisfactory rate. And I haven't forgotten about, you know, what's coming up. We do have an announcement in the next day or so for the next book. I'm actually going to announce the next two books at the same time. And on top of that, there is another special announcement coming. All kinds of announcements, actually. One cool thing is if you go to your browser and type in thehemingwaylist.com, you'll see that that's the new URL for the podcast. So you can still find the podcast by searching A Year of War and Peace, but thehemingwaylist.com is the home. And I'm starting to adjust that website so that it's all categorized by all the different books that we're going to read. Putting a little introduction page in there. And I'm also putting a chapter, like an index of all the chapters of A Year of War and Peace. It's a whole thing. Anyway, the website isn't the exciting news. The exciting news is coming in the next, I'm going to say, 2 days. It might be in tomorrow's episode. It might not be, but it will definitely be in the episode after that. So within the next couple of days, we'll be announcing the books that we're going to go on to, which will give you plenty of time to get them before the end of the year. Give you even enough time to get them on your Christmas list and maybe get them for Christmas. All right, that's going to do us for today. Thank you very much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.